my heart. How true it is that nothing is sweeter than home and kindred. Although you may have a rich house in a foreign land far away from your kindred. Ah, well, but you are waiting to hear of my journey home and all the sorrows which Zeus laid upon me after I left Troy. From Ilion the wind carried me to Ismarus of the Siconians. There I destroyed the city and killed the men. We spared the women and plenty of cattle and goods, which we divided to give each man a fair share. I told the men we must show a light heel and be off, but the poor fools would not listen. Plenty of wine was drunk, plenty of sheep were killed on that beach, and herds of cattle. Meanwhile, some of the enemy got away and shouted to other Siconians, neighbors of their island, more men and better men who knew how to fight from the chariot against a foe, and on foot, if need be. A multitude of these men swarmed down early in the morning. As many as leaves and flowers in the season of the year. Surely Zeus sent us a hard fate that day to bring trouble on a lot of poor devils. They drew up near the ships, and then came volleys on both sides. All through the morning, while the day grew stronger, we stood our ground and held them off, although they outnumbered us. But when the sun began to change course, about ox-loosing time, the Siconians got the upper hand and bent our line. 6 men-at-arms from each vessel were killed, and the rest of us were saved alive. From that place we sailed onward, much discouraged, but glad to have escaped death, although we had lost good companions. Yet we did not let the galleys go off until we had called thrice on the name of each of our hapless comrades who died in that place. But Zeus Cloud-Gatherer sent a nor'wester upon our fleet with a furious tempest, bringing clouds over land and sea, and night rushed down from the sky. The ships were blown, plunging along. The sails were split into shreds and tatters by the violence of the wind. We let down the sails in fear of death and rowed the bare hulls to shore. There we lay 2 days and 2 nights on end, eating out our hearts with hardship and anxiety. But when the 3rd day showed welcome streaks of light, we stepped the masts and hoisted new sails and sat still while the wind drove us on and the steersman held the way. Then I might have come safe to my native land, but the sea and the current and the northwest wind caught me as I was doubling Cape Malea and drifted me outside Cythera. 9 days after that I was beaten about on the sea by foul winds. And on the 10th day we made land in the country of the lotus-eaters, who get their food from flowers. We went ashore and took in water, and the men made their meal on the spot close to the ships. When we had eaten and drunk, I sent some of them to find out who the natives were, 2 picked men with a speaker. Before long they came across some of the lotus-eaters. However, they did no harm to the men, only gave them some of their lotus to eat. As soon as they tasted that honey-sweet fruit, they thought no more of coming back to us with news, but chose rather to stay there with the lotus-eating natives and chew their lotus and good-bye to home. I brought them back to the ships by main force, grumbling and complaining, and when I had them there, tied them up and stowed them under the benches. Then I ordered the rest to hurry up and get aboard, for I did not want them to have a taste of lotus and say good-bye to home. They were soon on board and sitting on their benches and rowing away over the sea. From that place we sailed on in low spirits. We came next to the Cyclopians, the Goggle Eyes, a violent and lawless tribe. They trust to providence and neither plant nor plow, but everything grows without sowing or plowing, wheat and barley and vines which bear grapes in huge bunches, and the rain from heaven makes them grow of themselves. These Cyclopians have no parliament for debates and no laws, but they live on high mountains in hollow caves. Each one lays down the law for wife and children, and no one cares for his neighbors. Now a low, flat island lies across their harbor, not very near the land and not very far, covered with trees. In this are an infinite number of wild goats, for no man walks there to scare them away, and no hunters frequent the place to follow their toilsome trade in the forests and the hills. So it has neither flocks nor tillage, But unsown and unploughed, untrodden of men, it feeds the bleating goats. For the goggle-eyes have no ships with their crimson cheeks, and no shipwrights among them, to build boats for them to row in and visit the cities of the world, like men who traverse the seas on their lawful occasions. Such craftsmen might have civilized the island, for it is not a bad island. It could produce all the kindly fruits of the earth. There are meadows along the shore, soft land with plenty of water. There might be no end of grapes. There is smooth land for the plough. The soil is very rich, and they might always stack a good harvest in the season of the year. There is a harbor with easy riding. No cable is wanted, no anchor stones or stern hawsers. You just beach your ship and stay till the sailors have a fancy to go and the wind blows fair. Moreover, at the head of the harbor there is glorious water, a spring running out of a cave, with poplars growing all round. Some providence guided us in through the dark night, with not a thing to be seen, for a thick mist was about our ships, and the moon showed no light through the clouds. At that time we did not catch a glimpse of the island. Indeed, we saw no long breakers rolling towards the land before our ships ran up on the beach. When they were safe there, we lowered the sails and got out on the shore, and slept heavily until the dawn. As soon as dawn gleamed through the mist, we roamed about and admired the island. Then those kindly daughters of Zeus, the nymphs, sent down goats from the hills to give us all a good meal. We lost no time, got our bows and long spears out of the ships, divided into three bands, and let fly at the quarry. Very soon God gave us as much as we wanted. I had 12 ships with me, and 9 goats were given to each by lot, but 10 were picked out for me alone. So all day long we sat there feasting with plenty of meat and delicious wine. For the good red wine was not all used up yet, but some was left. When we took the Siconian city, each crew had supplied themselves with plenty in large 2-handled jars. We gazed at the country of the goggle-eyes, which was quite close. We could see the smoke and hear the bleating of sheep and goats. When the sun set and darkness came, we lay down on the beach to sleep. But with the first rosy streaks of the dawn, I called a meeting and made a speech to the men. "My good fellows," I said, "the rest of you stay here while I take my ship and crew and see who these people are, whether they are wild savages who know no law, or hospitable men who know right from wrong." So I went aboard and told my crew to cast loose. They were soon in their places and rowing along. The land was not far off, and when we reached it, we saw a cave there on a headland close by the sea, high and shaded with laurels, in which numbers of animals were housed by night, both sheep and goats. Outside was an enclosure with high walls round it, made of great stones dug into the earth, and the trunks of tall pines and spreading oaks. These were the night quarters of a monstrous man, who was then tending his flocks a long way off by himself. He would not mix with the others, but kept apart in his own lawless company. Indeed, he was a wonderful monster, not like a mortal man who eats bread, but rather like a mountain peak, with trees on the top, standing up alone in the highlands. Then I told the rest of my men to wait for me and look after the ship, but I picked out 12 of the best men I had, and we set out. I took with me a goatskin of ruby wine, delicious wine, which I had from Maranuanthides, priest of Apollo, who was the protecting god of Ismarus. We had saved him and his wife and child out of reverence because he lived in the sacred grove of Phoebus Apollo. I had glorious gifts from him. He gave me 7 talents weight of worked gold. He gave me a mixing bowl of solid silver. But besides that, he gave me great jars of wine, a whole dozen of them, delicious wine, not a drop of water in it, a divine drink. Not a soul knew about this wine, none of the servants or women, except himself and his own wife and 1 cellarer. When they drank of this wine, he used to pour 1 cup of it into 20 measures of water, and a sweet scent was diffused abroad from the mixer, something heavenly. No one wanted to be an abstainer then. I had filled a skin with this wine and brought it with me. Also a bag of provisions, for from the first I had a foreboding that I should meet a man of mighty strength, but savage. knowing neither justice nor law. We walked briskly to the cave, but found him not at home. He was tending his fat flocks on the pasture. So we entered the cave and took a good look all round. There were baskets loaded with cheeses. There were pens stuffed full of lambs and kids. Each lot was kept in a separate place, firstlings in one, middlings in another, yinlings in another. Every pot and pan was swimming with whey, all the pails and basins into which he did the milking. The men begged me first to let them help themselves to the cheeses and be off. Next they wanted to make haste and drive the kids and lambs out of the pens and get under sail. But I would not listen. Indeed, it would have been much better if I had. But I wanted to see himself and claim the stranger's gift. As it turned out, he was destined to be anything but a vision of joy to my comrades. So we lit a fire and made our thank-offering and helped ourselves to as many cheeses as we wanted to eat. Then we sat inside till he should come back with his flocks. At last, in he came, carrying a tremendous load of dry wood to give light for supper. This he threw down inside the cave with a crash that terrified us and sent us scurrying into the corners. Then he drove his fat flocks into the cave, that is to say, all he milked, leaving the rams and billy goats outside the cave, but within the high walls of the enclosure. Then he picked up a huge, great stone and placed it in the doorway. Not 2 and 20 good carts with 4 wheels apiece could have lifted it off the ground. Such was the size of the precipitous rock which he planted in front of the entrance. Then he sat down and milked the goats and ewes, bleating loudly all in order, and put her young under each. Next he curdled half of the white milk and packed it into wicker baskets, leaving the other half to stand in bowls that he might have some to drink for supper or whenever he wanted. At last, after all this busy work, he lighted the fire and saw us.
"Who are you?" he called out. "Where do you come from over the watery ways? Are you traitors, or a lot of pirates ready to kill and be killed, bringing trouble to foreigners?"
While he spoke, our hearts were wholly broken within us to see this horrible monster, and to hear that beastly voice. But I managed to answer him. "We are Achaeans from Troy, driven out of our course over the broad sea by all the winds of heaven. We meant to sail straight home, but we have lost our way altogether. Such was the will of Zeus, I suppose. We have the honor to be the people of King Agamemnon Atrides, whose fame is greatest of all men under the sky, for the strong city he sacked and the many nations he conquered. But we have found you, and come to your knees to pray if you will give us the stranger's due, or anything you may think proper to give to a stranger. Respect the gods, most noble sir. See, we are your suppliants. Strangers and suppliants have their guardian strong. God walks with them to see they get no wrong." He answered me with cruel words.
"You are a fool, stranger, or you come from a long way off if you expect me to fear gods. Zeus Almighty be damned, and his blessed gods with him. We Cyclopians care nothing for them. We are stronger than they are. I should not worry about Zeus if I wanted to lay hands on you or your companions. But tell me, where did you moor your ship? Far off or close by? I should be glad to know that."
He was just trying it on, but I knew something of the world and saw through it. So I answered back, "My ship was wrecked by Poseidon Earthshaker, who cast us on the rocks near the boundary of your country. The wind drove us on a lee shore, but I was saved with these others." The cruel monster made no answer, but just jumped up and reached out towards my men, grabbed 2 like a pair of puppies, and dashed them on the ground. Their brains ran out and soaked into the earth. Then he cut them up limb by limb, and made them ready for supper. He devoured them like a mountain lion, bowels and flesh and marrow bones, and left nothing. We groaned aloud, lifting our hands to Zeus when we saw this brutal business, but there was nothing to be done. When Goggle-Eye had filled his great belly with his meal of human flesh, washed down with a draught of milk neat, he lay and stretched himself among the sheep. But I did not lose heart. I considered whether to go near and draw my sharp sword and drive it into his breast. I could feel about till I found the place where the midriff encloses the liver. But second thoughts kept me back. We should have perished ourselves in that place, dead and done for. We could never have moved the great stone which he had planted in the doorway. So we lay groaning and awaited the dawn. Dawn came. He lit the fire, milked his flocks all in order, put the young under each. Then he grabbed two more men and prepared his breakfast. That done, he drove out the fat flocks, moving away the great stone with ease. But he put it back again, just as you fit cover to quiver. With many a whistle, Goggle-Eye turned his fat flocks to the hills. But I was left brooding and full of dark plans, longing to have my revenge if Athena would grant my prayer. Among all my schemes and machinations, the best plan I could think of was this. A long spar was lying beside the pen, a sapling of green olive wood. Goggle-Eye had cut it down to dry it and use as a staff. It looked to us about as large as the mast of a 20-oar ship, some broad hoy that sails the deep sea. It was about that length and thickness. I cut off a fathom of this and handed it over to my men to dress down. They made it smooth. Then I sharpened the end and charred it in the hot fire and hid it carefully under the dung which lay in a great mass all over the floor. Then I told the others to cast lots who should help me with the pole and rub it into his eye while he was sound asleep. The lot fell on those four whom I would have chosen myself, which made five, counting me. In the evening, back he came with his flocks. This time he drove them all into the cave and left none outside in the yard. Whether he suspected something or God made him do it, I do not know. Then he lifted the great stone and set it in place, sat down and milked his ewes and nannies, bleating loudly, all in order, put her young under each, and when all this was done, grabbed two more men and made his meal. At this moment I came near to Goggle-Eye, holding in my hand an ivory-wood cup full of the red wine, and I said, "Cyclops, here, have a drink after that jolly meal of man's mutton. I should like to show you what drink we had on board our ship. I brought it as a drink offering for you, in the hope that you might have pity and help me on my way home. But you are mad beyond all bearing." Hard heart, how can you expect any other men to pay you a visit, for you have done what is not right? He took it and swallowed it down. The good stuff delighted him terribly, and he asked for another drink.
Oh, please give me more, and tell me your name this very minute. I will give you a stranger's gift which will make you happy. Mother Earth does give us wine in huge bunches, even in this part of the world, and the rain from heaven makes them grow. But this is a rivulet of nectar and ambrosia.
Then I gave him a second draught. Three drinks I gave him. Three times the fool drank. At last, when the wine had got into his head, I said to him in the gentlest of tones, "Cyclops, do you ask me my name? Well, I will tell you, and you shall give me the stranger's due as you promised. No man is my name. No man is what mother and father call me, and all my friends."
Then the cruel monster said, "No man shall be last eaten of his company, and all the others shall be eaten before him. That shall be your stranger's gift."
As he said this, down he slipped and rolled on his back. His thick neck drooped sideways, and all-conquering sleep laid hold on him. Wine dribbled out of his gullet with lumps of human flesh as he belched in his drunken slumbers. Then I drove the pole deep under the ashes to grow hot, and spoke to hearten my men that no one might fail me through fear. As soon as the wood was on the point of catching fire and glowed white-hot green as it was, I drew it quickly out of the fire while my men stood round me. God breathed great courage into us then. The men took hold of the stake and thrust the sharp point into his eye, and I leaned hard on it from above and turned it round and round, as a man bores a ship's timber with an auger, while others at the lower part keep turning it with a strap which they hold at each end, and round it runs. So we held the fire-sharpened pole and turned it, and the blood bubbled about its hot point. The fumes singed eyelids and eyelashes all about, as the eyeball burnt and the roots crackled in the fire. As a smith plunges an axe or an adze in cold water, for that makes the strength of steel, and it hisses loud when he tempers it, so his eye sizzled about the pole of olive wood. He gave a horrible bellow till the rocks rang again, and we shrank away in fear. Then he dragged out the post from his eye, dabbled and dripping with blood, and threw it from him, wringing his hands in wild agony, and roared aloud to the Cyclopians who lived in caves round about among the windy hills. They heard his cries and came, thronging from all directions, and stood about the cave, asking what his trouble was. "What on earth is the matter with you, Polyphemus?" they called out. "Why do you shout like this through the night and wake us all up? Is any man driving away your flocks against your will? Is anyone trying to kill you by craft or main force?" Out of the cave came the voice of mighty Polyphemus. "Oh, my friends, no man is killing me by craft and not by main force." They answered him in plain words. "Well, if no man is using force, and you are alone, there's no help for a bit of sickness when heaven sends it, so you had better say your prayers to Lord Poseidon, your father." With these words, away they went, and my heart laughed within me to think how a mere nobody had taken them all in with my machinations. But the Cyclops, groaning and writhing in agony, fumbled about with his hands until he found the stone and pushed it away from the entrance. There he sat with his hands outspread to catch anyone who tried to go out with the animals. A great fool he must have thought me. But I had been casting about what to do for the best if I could possibly find some escape from death for my comrades and myself. All kinds of schemes and machinations I wove in my wits, for it was life or death, and perdition was close by. The plan that seemed to me best was this. The rams were well grown, large and fine, with coats of rich dark wool. In dead silence, I tied them together with twisted withes, which the monster used for his bed. I tied them in threes, with a man under the middle one, while the two others protected him on each side. So three carried each of our fellows. But for myself, there was one great ram, the finest of the whole flock. I threw my arms over his back and curled myself under his shaggy belly, and there I lay, turned upwards, with only my hands to hold fast by the wonderful fleece in patience. So we all waited anxiously for the dawn. At last the dawn came. The rams and billies surged out to pasture, but the nannies and ewes, unmilked, went bleating round the pens, for their udders were full to bursting. Their master, still tormented with pain, felt over the backs of all the animals as they passed out. But the poor fool did not notice how my men were tied under their bellies. Last of all, the great ram stalked to the door, cumbered with the weight of his wool and of me and my teeming mind. Polyphemus said as he pawed him over,
"Hello, why are you last today, you lazy creature? It is not your way to let them leave you behind. No, no, you go first by a long way to crop the fresh grass, stepping high and large, first to drink at the river, first all eagerness to come home in the evening, but now last. Are you sorry, perhaps, for your master's eye, which a damned villain has blinded with his cursed companions after he had fuddled me with wine? No man who hasn't yet escaped the death in store for him, I tell him that. If you only had sense like me, if you could only speak and tell me where the man is skulking from my vengeance, wouldn't I beat his head on the ground? Wouldn't his brains go splashing all over the place?
and then I should have some little consolation for the trouble which this nobody of a no-man has brought upon me. So he let the ram go from him out of the cave. A little way from the cave and its enclosure I shook myself loose first from under my ram, then I freed my companions, and with all speed we drove the fat animals trotting along, often looking round, until we reached our ship. Glad indeed our friends were to see us, all of us that were left alive. They lamented the others and made such a noise that I had to stop it, frowning at them and shaking my head. I told them to look sharp and throw on board a number of the fleecy beasts and get away. Soon they were in their places, paddling along, but when we were about as far off from the shore as a man can shout, I called out in mockery, "I say, Cyclops! He didn't turn out to be such a milksop after all, did he, when you murdered his friends and gobbled them up in your cave? Your sins were sure to find you out, you cruel brute. You had no scruple to devour your guests in your own house. Therefore vengeance has fallen upon you from Zeus and the gods in heaven." This made him more furious than ever. He broke off the peak of a tall rock and threw it. The rock fell in front of the ship. The sea splashed and surged up as it fell. It raised a wave which carried us back to the land, and the rolling swell drove the ship right upon the shore. I picked up a long quant and pushed her off and nodded to the men as a hint to row hard and save their lives. You may be sure they put their backs into it. When we were twice as far as before, I wanted to shout again to Goggle Eye, although my comrades all round tried to coax me not to do it. "Foolhardy man, why do you want to provoke the madman? Just now he threw something to seaward of us and drove back the ship to land, and we thought all was up with us. And if he had heard one of us speaking or making a sound, he would have thrown a jagged rock and smashed our timbers and our bones to smithereens. He throws far enough." But I was determined not to listen, and shouted again in my fury, "I say, Cyclops, if ever anyone asks you who put out your ugly eye, tell him your blinder was Odysseus, the conqueror of Troy, the son of Laertes, whose address is in Ithaca." When he heard this, he gave a loud cry and said, "Upon my word, this is the old prophecy come true. There was a soothsayer here once, a fine, tall fellow, Telemus Eurymedes, a famous soothsayer, who lived to old age, prophesying amongst our people. He told me what was to happen, that I should lose my sight at the hands of Odysseus. But I always expected that some tall, handsome fellow would come this way, clothed in mighty power. Now a nobody, a weakling, a whippersnapper has blinded my eye after fuddling me with wine. Come to me, dear Odysseus, and let me give you the stranger's gift. Let me beseech the worshipful earth-shaker to grant you a happy voyage, for I have the honor to be his son, and he declares he is my father. He will cure me if he chooses, all by himself, without the help of blessed gods or mortal man." I answered at once, "I wish I could kill you and send you to hell as surely as no one will ever unblind your eye, not even the earth-shaker." At this he held out his hand to heaven and prayed to Lord Poseidon. "Hear me, Poseidon Earth-holder Sea-Blue Hair. If I am truly thy son, and thou art indeed my father, grant that Odysseus, the conqueror of Troy, the son of Laertes, whose address is in Ithaca, may never reach his home. But if it is his due portion to see his friends and come again to his tall house and his native land, may he come there late and in misery, in another man's ship. May he lose all his companions, and may he find tribulation at home." This was his prayer, and Sea Blue Hair heard it. Then once again he lifted a stone greater than the other and circled it round his head, gathering all his vast strength for the blow, and flung it. Down it fell behind our ship just a little, just missed the end of the steering oar. The sea splashed and surged up as it fell, and the wave carried her on and drove her to shore on the island. When we came safe to the island where the other ships were waiting for us, we found our companions in great anxiety, hoping against hope. We drew up our ship on the sand, and put the sheep of old Goggle Eye ashore, and divided them so as to give everyone a fair share. But by general consent, the great ram was given to me. I sacrificed him on the beach to Zeus Cronides. Clouds and darkness are round about him, and he rules over all. I made my burnt offering, but Zeus regarded it not. For as it turned out, he intended that all my tight ships and all my trusty companions should be destroyed. We spent the rest of the day until sunset in feasting, eating full and drinking deep, and when the sun set and darkness came on, we lay to rest on the seashore. Then at dawn I directed the men in all haste to embark and throw off the moorings. They were soon aboard, and rowing away in good fettle over the sea. So we fared onwards, thankful to be alive, but sorrowing for our comrades whom we had lost. Book 10. The Island of the Winds, the Land of the Midnight Sun, Circe. We came next to the island of Aeolia. There lived Aeolus Hippotades, a friend of the immortal gods, in a floating island. Right round it was built a brazen wall, unbreakable, and the rock ran up smooth and straight. Aeolus had a family of 12 children, 6 daughters and 6 sons in their prime. The daughters he had given to the sons as wives. All these live together and dine with their father and their excellent mother. There is always a fine spread of victuals in infinite variety. All day and every day the house is full of the steam of cooking, and the courtyard resounds with busy noise. All night they sleep beside their faithful wives on bedsteads of neat joinery covered with blankets and rugs. We entered this city with its fine houses, and there spent a whole month as guests. Aeolus wanted to know all about Ilion and the Achaean fleet and how they returned home, and I told him the whole history from beginning to end. When at last I spoke of leaving and asked him for help on our way, he was glad to consent and did everything he could. He gave me the skin of a 9-year ox, which he flayed for us and made into a bag, and in this he bottled up the blustering winds. For Cronion had appointed him to be manager of the winds, to hold them or to let them go as he liked. On board my ship he tied up the bag with wire of shining silver, so tight that not a breath could blow out, but he left the west wind free to blow, that it might carry our ships along. As it turned out, this was of no use, for we spoilt all by our own folly. 9 days we sailed all day and all night. On the 10th day, our native land came in sight. We came so close that we could see them tending their fires. All that time I had held the sheet in my hand and let no one else touch it to make sure of a quicker passage home. But when I saw the island, I fell into a deep sleep, for I was tired out. Then the men began to talk to one another. Said there must be gold and silver in that bag, presents from the generous Aeolus Hippotades. And this is the sort of thing they were whispering. Upon my word, the man is a prime favorite wherever he goes. Plenty of treasures from the spoils of Troy, and we who traveled the same road come home with empty hands. Now again, here is Aeolus obliging him with more generous gifts. Here, quick, let's look and see what he has got, how much gold and silver there is in this bag. A scandalous motion, but it was past. They opened the bag. The winds leaped out. At once a gale caught them and carried them off to sea, tearing their hair as they left their native land behind. This waked me up. I did not know what to do, whether to throw myself overboard and be drowned, or grin and bear it in the land of the living. Well, I just bore it and stayed where I was. I covered my head and lay down while the ships were driven by the gale back to the Isle of Aeolus, amid the lamentations of my companions. So we went ashore and took in fresh water, and the men had their meal beside the ships. When we had finished, I took with me a herald and one other, and went on to the house of Aeolus. We found him feasting with his wife and children. When we entered the hall and sat on the threshold near the door, they called out in great astonishment, What has brought you here, Odysseus? What ill luck has touched you? Surely we did everything we could to help you, that you might return safely to your native land, or anywhere else you wanted to go. I answered sorrowfully, Everything has been spoiled by the fault of my men, and sleep on top of that, confound it. Do help us, friends, you have the power. My coaxing was of no use. They were dumbfounded, and the father said, Get out of this island at once, you miserable sinner. It is not permitted to comfort the enemy of the blessed gods. Get out of this. You are the god's enemy. Come to my doors. Thus he turned me out of his house in deep distress. From that place we sailed on, disheartened. The spirit of the men was worn out by the labor of rowing, all their own fault, for there was no wind to help us now. 6 days we carried on, all night and all day. On the seventh we reached the lofty stronghold of Lamus, Laestrygonian Telepolis, where herdsman hails herdsman as one brings in his droves and the other answers as he drives out his. There, a man who could do without sleep could earn double wages, one by minding cattle, one by pasturing sheep, for the paths of day and night are close together. We entered a fine harbor with precipitous cliffs running all round. At the mouth were two headlands projecting front to front, and the entry is narrow. All the others steered their ships in and moored them inside the harbor, close together, for there were no waves rising inside, large or small, only white calm all round. But I alone made fast my ship outside, at the very end of the point, hitching ropes over the rocks. Then I climbed the cliff and stood still to get a good view. There was no arable land or garden to be seen, but we saw smoke rising in the air. So I sent some men to find out who the natives were, two picked men with a third as their spokesman. They went ashore and proceeded along a leveled road which was used by carts to carry down wood from the hills into the city. They came across a girl close to the city drawing water, the sturdy daughter of Laestrygonian Antiphates. She had come down to a running spring named Artesia, from which they used to get water for the city. The men stopped and asked who was king in those parts and who the people were. She answered at once and pointed out her father's lofty roof. When they entered the house, there they found his wife, a woman as big as the peak of a mountain, and they hated her at sight. She sent at once to summon her husband Antiphates from the town meeting. He gave them a murderous reception. One he grabbed at once and prepared for supper. The other two ran away and managed to get back to the ships, but the monster made a hue and cry through the city. Out came the Laestrygonians, rushing from every direction in thousands, great, inhuman wretches like giants. They threw showers of stones from the cliffs, each as big as a man could lift, and a mighty din there was, smashing of ships and crushing of men. The giants speared them like fishes and carried them home for a horrid supper. While this massacre was going on in the deep harbor, I drew my sword and cut the hawsers of my ship, and told my men to put their backs into it if they wanted to save their lives. Then row they did with the fear of death to help them. We blessed the open sea when we got clear of those grim rocks. My ship was the only one which escaped. All the rest were lost. From that place we sailed on, glad enough to have come off with our lives, but sad to lose our companions. Next we reached the island of Aea. There Circe lived, a terrible goddess with lovely hair, who spoke in the language of men, own sister to murderous Aeetes. Their father was Helios, who gave light to mankind, and their mother was Perse, a daughter of Oceanus. We brought our ship to the shore in silence, and some providence guided us into a harbor where ships could lie. There we spent 2 days and 2 nights on shore, eating out our hearts with weariness and woe. On the third day, as soon as dawn showed the first streaks of light, I took spear and sword and climbed to a high place, where I had a look round to see if there was anyone about or any voice to be heard. Standing on the top of a rock, I saw smoke rising into the air from the house where Circe lived in the middle of thick bushes and trees. When I saw the smoke glowing, I considered whether I should go and inquire. The best plan seemed to be that I should return first to our ship on the shore and give the men something to eat, and then send out to inquire. Just as I came near to the ship, some god must have pitied me there so lonely, and sent me a stag with towering antlers right on my path. He was going down to the river from his woodland range to drink, for the sun's heat was heavy on him. As he came out, I struck him on the spine in the middle of the back, and the spear ran right through. Down he fell in the dust with a moan and died. I set my foot on him and drew out the spear from the wound. Then I laid the body flat on the ground and pulled a quantity of twigs and withies, which I plaited across and twisted into a strong rope of a fathom's length. With this rope I tied together the legs of the great creature and strung him over my neck, and so carried him down to the ship, leaning upon my spear. I could not have carried him on the shoulder with one hand, for he was a huge beast. I threw him down in front of the ship and cheered up my friends with encouraging words as I turned from one to another. "We are not going to die yet, my friends, for all our troubles. We shall not see the house of Hades before our day comes. While there's food and drink in the ship, don't let us forget to eat. We need not die of starvation, at all events." They were all sitting about with their faces muffled up in their cloaks. But at my words they threw off the cloaks and got up quickly to stare at the stag lying on the beach, for he was a huge beast. When they had feasted their eyes on the welcome sight, they began to think of another kind of feast. So they swilled their hands in due form and got him ready. All day long until sunset we sat enjoying ourselves with our meat and wine, and when the sun went down and the darkness came, we lay down to sleep on the seashore. As soon as morning dawned, I called my companions together and addressed them. "My friends, we do not know east from west. We don't know where the sun rises to give light to all mankind and where he goes down under the earth. Well, then, what are we to do? We must try to think of something at once, and for my part I can't think of anything. I have just been up on the cliffs to look around. We are on some island in the middle of the sea with no land in sight. The island is flat, and I saw smoke rising in the air above a coppice of bushes and trees." When I said this, their hearts were crushed with foreboding, for they remembered the doings of Laestrygonian Antiphates, and the violence of that audacious cannibal, the goggle-eyed Cyclops. The tears ran down their cheeks, and much good it did to weep. However, I divided them into two parts of equal number, and chose a captain for each. One I took myself, the other I gave to an excellent man, Eurylochus. Quickly then we shook lots in a helmet, and out leapt the lot of Eurylochus. Off he went with his 22 men, groaning and grumbling, and we were left groaning and grumbling behind. They found in a dell the house of Circe, well built with shaped stones and set in a clearing. All round it were wolves and lions of the mountains, really men whom she had bewitched by giving them poisonous drugs. They did not attack the men, but romped up fawning on them and wagging their long tails, just like a lot of dogs playing about their master when he comes out after dinner, because they know he has always something nice for them in his pocket. So these wolves and lions, with their sharp claws, played about and pawed my men, who were frightened out of their wits by the terrible creatures. They stopped at the outer doors of the courtyard and heard the beautiful goddess within singing in a lovely voice as she worked at the web on her loom, a large web of incorruptible stuff, a glorious thing of delicate gossamer fabric such as goddesses make. The silence was broken by Polites, who was nearest and dearest to me of all my companions and the most trusty. He said, "Friends, I hear a voice in the house, some woman singing prettily at the loom, and the whole place echoes with it. Goddess or woman, let's go in and speak to her." Then they called her loudly. She came out at once and opened the shining doors and asked them to come in. They all followed her in their innocence. Only Eurylochus remained behind, for he suspected a trap. She gave them all comfortable seats and made them a posset, cheese and meal and pale honey mixed with Pramnian wine. but she put dangerous drugs in the mess to make them wholly forget their native land. When they had swallowed it, she gave them a tap of her wand at once and herded them into pens, for they now had pigs' heads and grunts and bristles, pigs all over, except that their minds were the same as before. There they were then miserably shut up in the pigsty. Circe threw them a lot of beechnuts and acorns and cornel beans to eat, such as the earth-bedded swine are used to. But Eurylochus came back to the ship to tell the tale of his companions and their unkind fate. At first he could not utter a word, he was so dumbfounded with this misfortune. His eyes were full of tears, his mind foreboded trouble. At last, when we were fairly flummoxed with asking questions, he found his tongue and told us how all his companions had come to grief. "We went out into the wood, as you told us, most renowned chief, found a well-built house in a dell, and there someone was singing loudly as she worked the loom, goddess or woman. They called to her. She came out at once and opened the doors and asked them in. They all followed in the simplicity of their hearts, but I stayed behind because I suspected a trap. They all disappeared at once, not a soul was to be seen, and I stayed there a long time to spy." When he said this, at once I slung my sword over my shoulders, the large one bronze with silver knobs, and the bow with it, and told him to go back with me and show me the way. But he threw his arms about my knees and begged and prayed without disguise, "Don't take me there, my prince. I don't want to go. Let me stay here. I am sure you will never come back again, nor will anyone who goes with you. Let us get away with those who are here while we can. We have still a chance to escape the day of destruction." But I answered, "Very well, Eurylochus, you may stay here in this place, eat and drink beside the ship. But as for me, go I must and go I will." So I made my way up from the seaside. But just as I was on the point of entering the sacred dell, and finding the house of that mistress of many spells, who should meet me but Hermes with his golden rod? He looked like a young man with the first down on his lip, in the most charming time of youth. He grasped my hand and said, "Whither away again, you poor fellow, alone on the hills in a country you do not know? Your companions are shut up yonder in Circe's, like so many pigs cozy in their pigsties. Are you going to set them free? Why, I warn you that you will never come back. You will stay here with the others." "All right, I will help you and keep you safe. Here, take this charm, and then you may enter the house of Circe. This will keep destruction from your head. I will reveal to you all the malign arts of Circe. She will make you a posset and put drugs in the mess, but she will not be able to bewitch you for all that, for the good charm which I will give you will foil her. I will tell you exactly what to do. As soon as Circe gives you a tap with her long rod, draw your sword at once and rush upon her as if you meant to kill her. She will be terrified and will invite you to lie with her. Do not refuse, for you want her to free your companions and to entertain you. But tell her to swear the most solemn oath of the blessed gods that she will never attempt any other evil against you, or else, when you are stripped, she may unman you and make you a weakling." With these words, Argifontes handed me the charm which he had pulled out of the soil, and explained its nature. The root was black, but the flower was milk-white. The gods call it moly. It is hard for mortals to find it, but the gods can do all things. Then Hermes departed through the woody island to high Olympus. But I went on to Circe's house, and I mused deeply as I went. I stood at the doors. As I stood, I called loudly, and the beautiful goddess heard. Quickly she came out and opened the doors, and I followed her, much troubled. She led me to a fine carven chair covered with silver knobs, with a footstool for my feet. Then she mixed me a posset, and dropped in her drugs, with her heart full of wicked hopes. I swallowed it, but it did not bewitch me. Then she gave me a tap with her wand and said, "Now then, to the sty with you, and join your companions." I drew my sharp sword and leapt at Circe as though to kill her. She let out a loud shriek and ran up and embraced my knees and blurted out in dismay, "Who are you? Where do you come from in the wide world? Where is your city? Who are your parents? I am amazed that you have swallowed my drugs and you are not bewitched. Indeed, there never was another man who could stand these drugs once he had let them pass his teeth. But you must have a mind that cannot be bewitched. Surely you are Odysseus, the man who is never at a loss. Agiphontes Goldenrod used to say that you would come on your way from Troy in a ship. Come now, put up your sword in the sheath. Let us lie down on my bed and trust each other in love."
I answered her, "Ah, Circe, how could you bid me be gentle to you when you have turned my companions into pigs in this house? And now that you have me here with deceitfulness in your heart, you bid me to go to your bed in your chamber, that when I am stripped, you may unman me and make me a weakling. I will not enter your bed unless you can bring yourself to swear a solemn oath that you will never attempt any evil thing against me."
She swore the oath at once, and when she had sworn the oath fully and fairly, I entered the bed of Circe. Meanwhile, the four maids who served her had been doing their work in the house. These were daughters of springs and trees and sacred rivers that run down into the sea. One of them spread fine coverings upon the seats, a linen sheet beneath and a purple cloth upon it. The second drew tables of silver in front of the seats and laid on them golden baskets. The third mixed wine in a silver mixer, delicious honey-hearted wine, and set out cups of gold. The fourth brought water and kindled a great fire under a copper. The water grew warm, and when it boiled in the glittering cauldron, she led me to the bath and bathed me with water out of the cauldron, when she had tempered it to a pleasant warmth, pouring it over my head and shoulders to soothe the heartbreaking weariness from my limbs. And when she had bathed me and rubbed me with olive oil, she gave me a tunic and a wrap to wear. Then she led me to the fine carven seat and set a footstool under my feet and invited me to fall too. But this displeased me. I sat there half dazed, and my heart was full of foreboding. When Circe noticed that I sat still and did not touch the victuals, when she saw how deeply I was troubled, she came near and spoke her mind plainly. "Why do you sit there like a dumb man, Odysseus, and eat your heart out instead of eating your dinner? I suppose you expect some other treachery. You need not be afraid. I have sworn you a solemn oath."
I answered, "Ah, Circe, what man with any decent feeling could have the heart to taste food and drink until he should see his friends free and standing before his eyes? If you really mean this invitation to eat and drink, set them free that I may see my friends before my eyes."
Then Circe took her wand in hand and walked through the hall and opened the doors of the sty and drove them out looking like a lot of 9-year hogs. As they stood there, she went among them and rubbed a new drug upon each. Then the bristles all dropped off, which the pernicious drug had grown upon their skin. They became men once more, younger than they were before, and handsomer and taller. They knew me, and each grasped my hand. They sobbed aloud for joy, till the hall rang again with the noise, and even the goddess was touched. She came close to me and said, "Prince Laertiades, Odysseus, never at fault, go down to the seashore where your ship lies. First of all, draw up the ship on the beach and stow all your goods and tackle in a cave. Then come back yourself and bring the rest of your companions with you."
So I went, and when I reached the shore, I found my companions sitting beside the ship in deep distress. But as soon as they saw me, they were like so many calves in a barnyard, skipping about a drove of cows as they come back to the midden after a good feed of grass. They cannot keep in their pens, but frolic round their dams, lowing in a deafening chorus. So the men crowded round me, with tears running down over their cheeks. They felt as glad as if they had come back to their native land, to rugged Ithaca, their home, where they were born and bred. And they cried out from their hearts, "You are back again, my prince! How glad we are, as glad as if we had come safe home to Ithaca. Now do tell us what has become of our companions." I answered gently,
First of all, we will draw up the ship on shore, and store the tackle and all our belongings in some cave. Then bestir yourselves and come with me, all of you, and you shall see your companions in the sacred house of Circe, eating and drinking. They have enough and to spare. At once they set about the work. And now, what should I see but Eurylochus, alone, trying to stop them? He made no secret of his thoughts. "Oh, you poor fools!" he cried out. "Where are we going? Do you want to run your heads into trouble? Go to Circe's house and let her turn you all into lions or wolves to keep watch for her, whether we like it or not? Just Cyclops over again when our fellows went into his yard, and this same bold Odysseus with them. It was only his rashness that brought them to destruction." When I heard this, I thought for a moment that I would draw my sword and cut off his head and let it roll on the ground, for all he was my near relation. But the others held me back and did their best to soften me. "Let us leave the man here, Prince, if you please. Let him stay by the ship and look after the ship. Lead the way. We are going with you to Circe's house." Then away they went up from the shore. Indeed, Eurylochus would not be left behind. He came, too, for he had a terror of my rough tongue. Then Circe gave a bath in her house to my companions, and had them rubbed with olive oil, and gave them tunics and woolen wraps. We found all the others feasting merrily in the hall. When they saw one another face to face and knew one another, their feelings were too much for them. They made such a noise that the roof rang again, and the radiant goddess came up to me and said, "No more lamentations now, Odysseus. I know myself how many hardships you have suffered on the seas, and how many cruel enemies have attacked you on land. Now then, eat your food and drink your wine until you become as gay as when you first left your rugged home in Ithaca. Just now you are withered and downhearted. You can't forget your dismal wanderings. Your feelings are not in tune with good cheer, for assuredly you have suffered much." We took her advice, and there we remained for a whole year, with plenty to eat and good wine to drink. But when the year was past, and the seasons came round again, my companions called me aside and said, "Good heavens, have you forgotten home altogether? Do remember it, if it is really fated that you shall have a safe return to your great house and your native land." And so, when I came to Circe's bed, I entreated her earnestly, and she listened to what I had to say. "Keep the promise you made me, Circe, that you would help me on my homeward way. My mind is set upon it, and my companions, too. They were worrying about it, and grumbling all round me when you are not by." She answered, "Prince Laertides, never baffled Odysseus, I would not have you remain in my house unwillingly. But there is another journey you must make first. You must go to the house of Hades and offer Persephonea, to ask directions from Tiresias, the blind Theban seer. His mind is still sound, for even in death Persephonea has left him his reason. He alone has sense, and others are flitting shadows." This fairly broke my heart. I sat on the bed and groaned, and I no longer cared to live and see the light of the sun. But when I had worked off my feelings by groaning and writhing, I said to her, "Oh, Circe, who will be our guide to that place? No one has ever travelled to Hades in a ship." The beautiful goddess answered, "You need not hang about the ship and wait till a guide turns up. Set your mast, hoist your sail, and sit tight. The north wind will take you along. When you have crossed over the ocean, you will see a low shore and the groves of Persephonea. Tall poplars and fruit-wasting willows. There beach your ship beside deep-eddying Oceanus, and go on yourself to the mouldering house of Hades. There into Acheron, the river of pain, two streams flow, Periphlegethon, blazing with fire, and Cocytus, resounding with lamentation, which is a branch of the hateful water of Styx. A rock is there by which the two roaring streams unite. Draw near to this, brave man, and be careful to do as I bid you. Dig a pit of about 1 cubit's length along and across, and pour into it a drink offering for all souls. first with honey and milk, then with fine wine, the third time with water. Sprinkle over it white barley meal. Pray earnestly to the empty shells of the dead. Promise that if you return to Ithaca, you will sacrifice to them a farrow cow, the best you have, and heap the burning pile with fine things. And to Tiresias alone, in a different place, you will dedicate the best black ram you have in your flocks. After that, when you have made your prayers to the goodly company of the dead, sacrifice a black ram and a black ewe, turning their heads down towards Erebus. Then turn back yourself and move towards the ocean shore. The souls of the dead who have passed away will come in crowds. Then call your companions and bid them flay and burn the bodies which lie slaughtered, and pray to the gods, to mighty Hades and awful Persephonea. Draw your sword and sit still, but let none of the empty shells of the dead approach the blood. Before you ask Tiresias what you want to know, the seer will come at once, and he will tell you the way and the measure of your path, and how you may return home over the fish-giving sea. Even as she spoke, the dawn came, enthroned in gold. Circe gave me a tunic and cloak to wear, and herself put on a white shining robe, delicate and lovely, with a fine girdle of gold about her waist, and drew a veil over her head. I went through the house and aroused my companion, speaking gently to each man as I stood by him. "Sleep is sweet, but now no more drowsy slumber. Let us go. Circe has told me what to do." They obeyed me, full of courage. But even there we had trouble before we left. One of us, Elpina, the youngest of all, one not so very valiant in war or steady in mind, had been sleeping by himself on the roof to get cool, being heavy with wine. He heard the noise and bustle of the men moving about, and jumped up in a hurry, but his poor wits forgot to come down again by the long ladder. He fell off the roof and broke his neck, and his soul went down to Hades. When the men had all come, I said to them, "No doubt you think we are going straight home, but Circe has marked out another road for us, to the house of Hades and awful Persephonea." When I said this, it fairly broke their hearts. They sat down where they were and groaned and tore their hair, but it did them no good to lament. While we were on the way to our ship in sorrow and mourning, Circe had got there before us and left, fastened near the ship, a black ram and you. She slipped past us easily. Who could set eyes on a god if he did not wish it, going this way or coming that way? Book 11. How Odysseus Visited the Kingdom of the Dead. When we reached our ship lying on the beach, the first thing we did was to launch her into the sea. Then we set up mast and sail, and taking the ram and you, we embarked in no happy mind. The radiant goddess Circe sent a sail-filling wind behind us, a good companion for a voyage. We made all shipshape aboard and sat tight. Wind and helmsman kept her on her course. All day long we ran before the wind, with never a quiver on the sail. Then the sun set, and all the ways grew dark. We came at last to the deep stream of Oceanus, which is the world's boundary. There is the city of the Cimmerian people, wrapped in mist and cloud. Blazing Helios never looks down on them with his rays, nor when he mounts into the starry sky, nor when he returns from the sky to earth. But abominable night is forever spread over those unhappy mortals. There we beached our ship and put the animals ashore, and we walked along the shore until we came to the place which Circe had described. Perimedes and Eurylochus held fast the victims while I drew my sword and dug the pit, a cubit's length along and across. I poured out the drink offering for all souls, first with honey and milk, then with fine wine, and the third time with water, and I sprinkled white barley meal over it. Earnestly I prayed to the empty shells of the dead, and promised that when I came to Ithaca I would sacrifice to them in my own house a farrow cow, the best I had, and heap fine things on the blazing pile. To Tiresias alone, in a different place, I would dedicate the best black ram among my flocks. When I had made prayer and supplication to the company of the dead, I cut the victims' throats over the pit, and the red blood poured out. Then the souls of the dead who had passed away came up in a crowd from Erebus, young men and brides, old men who had suffered much, and tender maidens to whom sorrow was a new thing, others killed in battle, warriors clad in blood-stained armor. All this crowd gathered about the pit from every side with a dreadful great noise, which made me pale with fear. Then I told my men to take the victims which lay there slaughtered, to flay them and burn them, and to pray to mighty Hades and awful Persephonea. I myself, with drawn sword, sat still, and would not let the empty shells of the dead come near the blood, until I had asked my questions of Tiresias. First came the soul of my comrade Elpenor, for he had not yet been buried in the earth. We had left his body at Circe's house, unmourned and unburied, since other tasks were pressing. I was moved with pity for him, and my tears fell, as I asked him simply, "Elpenor, how came you to the gloomy west? You have beaten our ship with only your feet to walk on." He answered with a groan, "I was done for by bad luck and a mort of drink. I slept on Circe's roof and forgot to climb down by the long ladder, fell head over heels off the roof, broke my neck, and my soul came down to Hades. Now, I beseech you by those who are not here, those you left behind you, by your wife and your father who cared for you as a child, by Telemachus, your only son, whom you left at home, remember me, my prince, when you reach Aea. For I know you will touch there on your way back from Hades. Do not leave me unmourned and unburied. Do not desert me, or I may draw God's vengeance upon you. Burn me with all my arms, and pile up a barrow on the shore of the grey sea, that in days to come men may hear the story of an unhappy man. Do this for me, and plant my oar on the mound, the same oar which I used when I rowed with my companions." I heard and answered, "Be sure I will do this for you, my unhappy friend." As we exchanged these sad words, I stood on one side, holding my drawn sword over the blood, and my friend's phantom on the other, telling his long story. Then came the soul of my dead mother, Anticlia, daughter of the brave Autolycus. She was alive when I left Ithaca on my voyage to sacred Ilion. My tears fell when I saw her, and I was moved with pity. But all the same I would not let her come near the blood before I had asked my questions of Tiresias. Then came the soul of Theban Tiresias, holding a golden rod. He knew me, and said, "What brings you here, unhappy man, away from the light of the sun, to visit this unpleasing place of the dead? Move back from the pit. Hold off your sharp sword, that I may drink of the blood and tell you the truth." As he spoke, I stepped back from the pit and pushed my sword into the scabbard. He drank of the blood, and only then spoke as the prophet without reproach. "You seek to return home, mighty Odysseus, and home is sweet as honey. But God will make your voyage hard and dangerous, for I do not think the Earthshaker will fail to see you, and he is furious against you because you blinded his son. Nevertheless, you may all get safe home still, although not without suffering much. If you can control yourself and your companions when you have traversed the sea as far as the island of Thrinacia, there you will find the cattle and sheep of Helios, who sees all things and hears all things. If you sail on without hurting them, you may come safe to Ithaca, although not without suffering much. But if you do them hurt, then I foretell destruction for your ship and your crew. And if you can escape it yourself, you will arrive late and miserable, all your companions lost in the ship of a stranger. You will find trouble in your house, proud, blustering men who devour your substance and plague your wife to marry and offer their bridal gifts. But you shall exact retribution from these men." When you have killed them in your hall, whether by craft or open fight with the cold steel, you must take an oar with you and journey until you find men who do not know the sea, nor mix salt with their food. They have no crimson-cheeked ships, no handy oars, which are like so many wing feathers to a ship. I will give you an unmistakable token, which you cannot miss. When a wayfarer shall meet you and tell you, that is a winnowing shovel on your shoulder, fix the oar in the ground and make sacrifice to King Poseidon, a ram, a bull, and a boar pig. Then return home and make solemn sacrifice to the immortal gods who rule the broad heavens, every one in order. Death shall come to you from the sea. Death, ever so peaceful, shall take you off when comfortable old age shall be your only burden, and your people shall be happy round you. That which I tell you is true. I answered him, Ah, well, Tiresias, that is the thread which the gods have spun, and I have no say in the matter. But here is something I want to ask, if you will explain it to me. I see, over there, the soul of my dead mother. She remains in silence near the blood, and she would not look at the face of her own son or say a word to him. Tell me, prince, how may she know me for what I am? He answered, I will give you an easy rule to remember. If you let any one of the dead come near the blood, he will tell you what is true. If you refuse, he will go away. When he had said this, the soul of Prince Tiresias returned into the house of Hades, having uttered his oracles. But I stayed where I was until my mother came near and drank the red blood. At once she knew me, and made her meaning clear with lamentable words. My love, how did you come down to the cloudy gloom? And you alive? It is hard for the living to see this place. There are great rivers between, and terrible streams, Oceanus first of all, which no one can ever cross by walking, but only if he has a well-found ship. Are you on your way from Troy? Have you been wandering about with ship and crew all this time? Haven't you ever been back to Ithaca and seen your wife in your own house? I answered, Dear mother, necessity has brought me to the house of Hades, for I had to consult the soul of Tiresias the Theban. I have not been near Achaea, nor set foot in our country. I have been driven about incessantly, in toil and trouble, ever since I first sailed with King Agamemnon for Troy, to see its fine horses and to fight with its people. But do tell me, really and truly, what was the cause of your death? How did you die? Was it a long disease, or did Artemis Archeris kill you with her gentle shafts? And tell me about my father and the son I left behind me. Do they still hold my honors and my possessions, or have they passed to some other man because people think I will never return? And tell me of my own wedded wife, what she thinks and what she means to do. Does she remain with the boy and keep all safe? Or has she already married the best man who offered? My beloved mother answered at once, Aye, indeed, she does remain in your house. She has a patient heart, but her nights and days are consumed with tears and sorrow. Your honors and your possessions have not yet been taken away by any man, but Telemachus holds your demesne, and attends the public banquets as a ruling prince ought to do, for they all invite him. But your father stays there in the country and never comes to town. His bedding is not glossy rugs and blankets on a bedstead, but in winter he sleeps among the hinds in the house, in the dust beside the fire, and wears poor clothes. When summer comes and blooming autumn, he lies on the ground anywhere about the slope of his vineyard, on a heap of fallen leaves. There he lies, sorrowing, and will not be comforted. Longing for your return, old age weighs heavy upon him. And this is how I sickened and died. The archeress did not shoot me in my own house with those gentle shafts that never miss. It was no disease that made me pine away. But I missed you so much, and your clever wit and your gay merry ways. And life was sweet no longer, so I died. When I heard this, I longed to throw my arms round her neck. 3 times I tried to embrace the ghost. 3 times it slipped through my hands like a shadow or a dream. A sharp pang pierced my heart, and I cried out straight from my heart to hers, "Mother dear, why don't you stay with me when I long to embrace you? Let us relieve our hearts and have a good cry in each other's arms. Are you only a phantom which awful Persephone has sent to make me more unhappy than ever?" My dear mother answered,